supporting the French draft of the UN Security Council resolution, condemning Pyongyang's latest nuclear tests, and actively worked to ratchet up international pressure on the rogue regime. Yet, when Petrovsky stepped out of the conference room to take a call from his deputy in Moscow, Luganov sketched out an entirely different strategy with the FSB chief. Then, as if suddenly remembering that Alek was sitting there, he turned to his son-in-law and ordered him not to transcribe anything he was about to say next. Clearly, the president wanted no record of his daring gambit to flip Pyongyang from Beijing's sphere of influence to his own. Alek obediently put down his pen. He fully expected to be asked to step out of the room. But that order never came. The two men spoke in hushed voices for several minutes. Then Luganov instructed Nemkov to step out of the room and ask for fresh chai and some snacks to be brought in. After a steward delivered the order, he bowed slightly to the president and backed out of the conference room, shutting the door and leaving Luganov and Alek sitting alone together. Not even Agent Kovalyov was with them. Alek had 1,000 questions, none of which seemed prudent to ask. The truth was, he felt deeply conflicted. He abhorred what the North Koreans were doing and saw them as a grave threat not only to the whole of the Pacific Rim, but also to Russia herself. Their megalomaniacal leader would soon be armed with fully operational nuclear warheads and intercontinental ballistic missiles. Wouldn't he be difficult, if not impossible, to manage? How did the president not see he was creating a monster? At the same time, these were strategic matters far above his pay grade. He had tremendous respect for his father-in-law's ability to defend Mother Russia from all threats, at home and abroad. He'd seen the strong hand Luganov had used in Chechnya to great effect. The terrorist threat to the Russian people had largely disappeared. He had seen President Luganov show admirable strength and unexpected resolve in invading eastern Georgia. And while Alek regretted the loss of Georgian lives that had resulted, there was no question that his father-in-law's standing on the world stage had significantly, and counterintuitively, improved. Global leaders, and especially the Americans, now respected and even feared Luganov in a way they hadn't before the invasion. Alek could see the way the current American president, a weak and pitiful creature, was showing great deference to his father-in-law, and granting him surprising concessions in various trade and arms control negotiations, and a host of other matters. If that wasn't enough, Luganov's approval rating among the Russian people had soared following the invasion of Georgia. Before, it had hovered in the low to mid-60s. Afterward, it shot up to the mid-80s. Rather than be frightened or bothered by the move, the people had loved Luganov's show of raw Russian strength. They had loved his utter defiance of the global order, and especially his flouting of NATO and the Americans. They had certainly had their attention diverted from systemic economic troubles throughout the motherland and the rampant corruption inside Moscow, and they seemed happy to be so diverted. Their leader looked tough and decisive, especially while the weaklings in the West issued meaningless press releases and wrung their hands and whined about the need for order and stability and respect for international law. Contrary to Alek's concerns, there had been no negative consequences for Russia at all. This, in turn, had given the president a robust hand to demand the Duma provide hundreds of billions of additional rubles to rebuild Russia's military might and even modernize Russia's aging strategic nuclear forces. What's more, it gave Luganov tremendous leverage to exploit emerging vacuums in Central Asia, the Middle East, and Eastern and Central Europe. While he would never dare to say as much, Alec often sharply disagreed with his father-in-law's specific decisions. Still, he could not deny the man's take-no-prisoners brand of national leadership and global brinksmanship stirred something deep in the Russian soul, even his own. Selfishly, Alec hungered to be useful and successful, and thus respected by this man who dominated the stage. Now, after so many years, he was finally being entrusted with state secrets. Indeed, with secrets apparently too sensitive for even the defense minister himself. Luganov lit a cigar and leaned back in his white leather executive chair.
Alek Stefanovich, what would you say was the worst disaster of the 20th century?
The president asked out of thin air.
I don't know,
Alek mumbled, caught off guard by the randomness of the question.
World War II? Hitler's betrayal of Stalin? The siege of Leningrad? Ah, my son, you still have so much to learn,
Luganov replied, puffing on the aromatic cigar.
These developments hardly compare to the greatest catastrophe.
Alek's mind raced through the pages of modern Russian history.
The Bolshevik Revolution and the end of the Tsars?
He offered.
Tragic, but not the answer I am looking for, said Luganov. Think, Alek Stefanovich. Think harder.
Alek tried, but to his shame, he drew a blank.
The collapse of the Soviet Union, Luganov said at last. I am not now, nor was I ever, a true communist. I cannot say I truly approved of the rise of the Soviet system, its leaders, or its ways. But its utter collapse was without question the major geopolitical catastrophe of the century.
Alek said nothing.
In that moment, the greatness of the Russian mind, the beauty of the Russian language, the dominance of Russia's military, and the glory of Moscow itself were called into question around the globe,
Luganov expounded, smoke curling around his head like a halo.
Tens of millions of our citizens found themselves outside Russian territory, and of course, the epidemic of disintegration infected Russia itself.
Alek wasn't sure whether he should be taking notes. He would have preferred to. It would have given his hands something to do and a place for his eyes to focus. But in the end, he chose not to write, just to listen. He stared for a while at the conference table, then mustered up the courage to look at his father-in-law.
Every man has a destiny, Alek Stefanovich,
Luganov said.
Yours was to fall in love with my Marina and give me a grandson, a godson, a heritage, a legacy. This is good. It may be small, but it is noble. You are a family man, and you must always cherish and protect your family. You must always be loyal and true to your family.
He puffed away on the cigar.
My destiny is on a much grander scale,
Luganov continued.
The Russian people are my family. They are my children. I am their father, and my loyalties must be to them. They have suffered a cruel and humiliating blow from the barbarians in Washington, from the Zionists, from the blood-sucking bankers and the corrupt corporate chieftains and sleazy swindlers and the cruel conspirators of the NATO alliance and the eunuchs of the West. My children have had the bread ripped out of their hands, stolen right out of their mouths, their jobs, their dignity, their glorious heritage as Russians.
Alec had never heard the man speak this way. Not in private, certainly not in public. And he was not finished.
What did Dostoevsky say? Pain and suffering are always inevitable for a large intelligence and a deep heart. The really great men must, I think, have great sadness on earth.
The president stared out the window, and Alec followed his gaze. The night was dark. The moon was full. But it was on the other side of the plane. The only lights visible were those at the end of the wing, blinking red in the coal-black sky. Luganov set his cigar down and seemed to ponder the words.
The really great men must, I think, have great sadness on earth,
he said again, no longer to Alec, but to himself.
It falls to me to make things right, to cure the sadness of my people. My destiny is to restore the glory of Mother Russia. She must not only be great again, she must be seen as great, strong, proud, indomitable, invincible. This will take great courage. This will take great cunning. Not every step will make sense to the masses, or even to some of my cabinet. I will have to take risks that would cause lesser men to stumble, even if this brings us to war.
It was quiet for several moments. Alec briefly wondered if the man was expecting a response, though he had nothing to say. Then Luganov turned to him.
I have a mission, a destiny, Alec Stefanovich. And in this task, I dare not fail. The gods have determined that I am to save this great people from deprivation and deepest shame. For this, and for this alone, my name, and that of my family, shall be recorded in the annals of Russian history, like the great princes of our past.
Luganov abruptly leaned forward in his chair and motioned for Alec to come sit beside him. Alec complied. The scent of the cigar smoke was thick, but Alec did not mind it. His grandfather had loved cigars, Cubans, when he could get them, and the aroma brought back fond memories of sitting in his lap as a child, at the dacha on the Black Sea, listening to him tell stories of the czars and their exploits.
The people say I am brutal,
Luganov said, in a voice barely above a whisper.
I know it. I hear the talk. And it's true. I won't deny it. In defense of my nation's honor, I am more than willing to be brutal, vicious even. But this is no vice.
Once again, Alec felt deeply conflicted. He had longed to be close to this man, a true associate, an intimate, needed and respected. Yet just at the moment his father-in-law was really drawing him into his confidence, Alec felt unnerved by the man. He was not a normal leader. And Alec was uneasy when he considered the amount of power Luganov possessed, and his lack of accountability. To whom did he answer? Did he have any constraints at all? This was not what Alec had anticipated when he'd accepted a position in the government. Yet he understood the price of crossing this man. So Alec was becoming a master of personal discipline. He could not show the slightest flicker of fear, much less moral disapproval. Not unless he first made a careful exit strategy. Just then, Luganov looked in Alec's eyes and said something that nearly made him shudder, as if the man could read his most personal thoughts.
A dog can smell fear, Alex Stefanovich. When someone is afraid, a dog knows it, and he attacks. The same is true with an enemy. If you show the slightest hesitation, fear, doubt, lack of surety, your enemy will think he is stronger, that he has the upper hand. So you have only one option. When the moment is right, you must strike. You must go on the offensive. Hit first, and hit so hard that your enemy will not, cannot, rise to his feet. You must hit him with a crushing blow. And when you take him down, everyone else will be watching. Then they will fear you. Then they will respect you. That's when you have them. That's when you know you are the master, and they are the slaves.
29. James J. Rowley Training Center, Beltsville, Maryland, December 3, 2010. Looking back, Elena Riker wished she had just flat out said yes. After Marcus left the Marines with numerous medals and commendations, including the Navy Cross to go along with his Purple Heart, and worked in local law enforcement in Colorado Springs for several years, Marcus had asked his wife on numerous occasions if she had any problems with his desire to join the United States Secret Service and eventually protect the President of the United States. There simply weren't enough high-stakes responsibilities to keep Marcus satisfied in the Springs. Climbing 14ers, cliff diving, rock climbing, and skydiving didn't satiate his need for something bigger and more important. And while Elena had never actually said no to the question, as in, "No, I don't have any problems with you joining the Secret Service," she could hardly blame Marcus if he thought she had. The first time he'd asked, Elena had replied that she wasn't a big fan of moving to Washington, D.C. Still, she'd quickly added that she loved him and would support him wherever he wanted to go. The next time he'd asked was during the application and interview process. At that point, she'd said she loved the Front Range and the Rockies and wished they could live in the West for the rest of their lives. The last time he'd asked her was the day he'd received his acceptance letter in the mail and his start date for training. He'd apparently detected a look of concern in her eyes, which had likely prompted the question. By then, however, Elena concluded it was too late. No, she didn't like the idea one bit. But she really did love him. She knew better than anyone his thirst for adventure and his love of country. She felt selfish for wanting him to take a less dangerous road just to please her and their young son. And how could she say what she really felt now that he actually had the job? If she could only dial back the hands of time. Elena slipped her driver's license under the bulletproof glass and waited. She looked down at Lars. Having celebrated his 4th birthday in June, he looked adorable in his new suit, white dress shirt, and clip-on tie, all fresh off the rack from Sears. That morning at the hotel, she'd made him take a bath, trimmed his jet-black hair, and slicked it back with a bit of the gel Marcus used. She'd even bought him a cheap pair of sunglasses from Walgreens so he could look just like Daddy. Now their son was beaming, full of anticipation, as he held Elena's hand and kept asking when they could go into the auditorium. A moment later, Elena was handed back her ID and given 2 visitor passes. She put one lanyard around her neck and the other around Lars's. Then they got in line, put their belongings through the X-ray machine, passed through the magnetometers, and entered with the other nicely dressed and freshly scrubbed families. Lars picked the seats, in the middle and close to the front, as usual. He was off the charts excited about this day, one he'd been anticipating since Marcus had started his training. And Elena remained on her best behavior, keeping her many and growing reservations to herself. Her husband had been selected out of thousands of applicants. He had passed his training with the highest marks. Maybe this really was God's perfect plan for his life, for all their lives. Who was she to say otherwise? The ceremony began precisely at 10 that brisk December morning. A senior agent, who looked to be in his mid-40s, walked on stage and stepped up to the microphone. He gave some introductory remarks, and then introduced the director of the United States Secret Service.
Good morning. It is my great honor to welcome all of the spouses and children, families and friends who have traveled some a great distance to be with us today.
The director, a silver-haired gentleman in his 60s, began.
I remember this day well, both as the son of a special agent, watching my father take the oath of office in 1967, and years later as a graduate myself, taking the oath to join this elite cadre of America's brightest and most brave. I remember the pride I felt, becoming part of a team dedicated to defending our most sacred national institutions, our leaders, and our currency and financial systems. I remember how difficult it was to explain to family and friends why I would be willing to train so hard and work such long hours, and be away from home so often, and even lay down my life, if necessary, to safeguard our values and our democratic system of government. But I also remember the pride and sense of accomplishment I felt that day, and every day since. And I see that same sense of pride and devotion in each of your eyes.
The director commended the graduates for passing the exhaustive background checks and rigorous testing and demanding physical preparation required to join the 3,200 special agents and 1,300 uniformed officers of the Secret Service. He spoke of the history of the organization, its founding in 1865, and its evolving roles and responsibilities over the years. Elena knew Lars would remember none of the words. She likely wouldn't either. She doubted that even Marcus would. But none of them would ever forget the feeling of being inducted into something special, something honorable and good. Then came the big moment. The director asked the trainees to stand, raise their right hands, and repeat after him. Elena lifted Lars up so he could see his father. They were just a few rows behind him, so they had a great view. Lars had chosen well.
I, Marcus Johannes Riker.
I, Marcus Johannes Riker,
his wife and son repeated to each other in a whisper. Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
That I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
So that was that, Elena thought, as the room erupted in applause. She was now the wife of a special agent of the United States Secret Service. She had known since the sixth grade that she'd fallen in love with a boy who loved big risks and great adventure. She could hardly hold it against him now. Yet truth be told, she did. 30. Moscow, December 2011. I say let the world go to hell, but I should always have my tea. Dostoevsky's line in Notes from the Underground, his 1864 novella, echoed in Alec's thoughts as he brewed a pot of chai. Was he becoming the misanthropic civil servant whose notes formed the story? Was he the sick man, the spiteful man, the unattractive man, of whom the great bard of Russian literature crafted his tale? No, Alec thought. It was worse. He wasn't merely a despondent man who felt trapped. He was Ivan Denisovich, sentenced to hard labor and unable to escape. When the president asked Alec to come with him to a G20 summit, Alec had, of course, said yes. What else was he to do? Marina was angry with him, though, complaining bitterly that he was never home anymore, that he was neglecting his family, that he was neglecting her. In a rare flash of rage, he slapped her across the face, driving her to the floor. "Why don't you go shopping?" he fumed. This was not like him. But rather than apologize, he packed his suitcase and headed outside to the car waiting to take him to the airport. Despite smoking half a pack on the way, he was still shaken by the fight with his wife as he boarded the plane. He was shaken further when Luganov told him to write him a speech that would dazzle the leaders of the Western powers. The president wanted to make a forceful denunciation of all nuclear and ballistic missile programs of the regime in Pyongyang, including a powerful argument for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Alec had never written a speech before. He wasn't sure he could now. He agreed, reluctantly. The position Luganov had outlined was one Alec privately but heartily held, so it would not be difficult for him to make that case. What gnawed at him was the knowledge that he had just been commissioned to draft a speech explicitly designed to camouflage the president's true position. The man was, after all, actively, if clandestinely, aiding Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, not seeking to bring them to a halt. 2 months later, Luganov asked Alec to travel with him to Riyadh, Cairo, Amman, Jerusalem, and Ramallah. The president's trust in him was growing, but so were the tensions between Alec and Marina. They did their best not to fight in front of Vasily, but the bitter realities of life in this pressure cooker were having a demonstrative and corrosive effect on their marriage. Alec wondered if the only way to rekindle their love would be for him to stop working for the president and go back to life as a private sector lawyer, far from the daily pressures inside the Kremlin. But he couldn't see a way out. To be sure, his moral revulsion was growing, slowly but steadily. Yet there was also something intoxicating about being so close to the vortex of power. There were days Alec resolved to resign and take Marina and Vasily to another city or country to start afresh. Yet he never acted upon such instincts, and then he hated himself for his lack of courage. It was a vicious cycle of revulsion and regret, mixed with approbation and advancement, and it was all wreaking havoc on his digestive system. He was having trouble eating certain foods. He was having trouble getting enough rest at night. In time, he began battling heartburn and then colitis. Yet it was easier to change his diet and take a growing handful of pharmaceuticals than to confront his wife, much less her father, and take an exit ramp off this road. Soon, Alec Kraskin was not simply taking notes, but drafting Luganov's speeches, statements, and various other official communiques. He was also getting an inside look at how the Russian leader wielded power. With the Arab leaders, Luganov offered state-of-the-art weaponry, financing to build nuclear power plants, and muscular political support for their pet issues at the United Nations. Without being so explicit, he was wooing the Arabs away from Washington and back into Moscow's camp, where they'd been during the Cold War. Alek had to admit, if only to himself, it was a supremely seductive performance. To the Jews in Israel, Luganov portrayed himself as a man of peace, a fair and balanced interlocutor capable of bringing the Arabs to the table to make a sweeping and comprehensive peace treaty. But all this was a smokescreen, Alek knew. Luganov's actual objectives were twofold. The first was to lull the Zionists into a false sense of security, while the president earned billions in payoffs from Russian oligarchs arming Israel's enemies. The second was to entice them to let Russian companies invest in the massive fields of natural gas recently discovered off the Israeli coast, even as he secretly plotted to disrupt or even destroy those projects. The whole performance was both distressing and breathtaking to behold. Alek was constantly amazed that such rank dissembling could prove so utterly effective. 6 weeks after the Middle East trip, the two men were jetting off to Berlin, Paris, and Rome. Alek sat spellbound, watching the president wine and dine the highest-ranking European political and business leaders, concluding one lucrative joint venture after another, each crafted in such a way that personally, if always covertly, enriched Luganov. As always, Alek was in charge of drafting letters and memos on behalf of the president to world leaders and to key figures throughout Russia. By the end of 2012, Alek was unexpectedly awarded a promotion and a new title, Counselor to the President. With it, he received a sizable bonus and a hefty pay raise. Far too hefty for Alek, as it happened. He was convinced it was dirty money. But he asked no questions, and Marina was thrilled because her father insisted the couple take a few weeks of well-deserved vacation. Frankly, Alek hadn't seen his wife this happy, or happy at all, in quite some time. She asked if they could go to Monte Carlo for old time's sake, just the two of them. Alek was touched by the request, and quickly made the arrangements. His parents agreed to watch Vasily. Marina and Alek flew first class. They ate at fancy restaurants. They danced in nightclubs. Marina spent far too much money shopping. Alek lost far too much money at the blackjack tables and roulette wheels. It wasn't quite the same as their honeymoon in Macau, but it was almost as good. And when they got home, they discovered Marina was pregnant again. Alek hoped this could be the start of a new chapter in both of their lives. Sadly, however, Marina lost the baby 4 months later and developed an infection that nearly took her life. Alek was away on another foreign trip when she was rushed to the hospital. It was all over by the time he returned to Moscow. Though she never said as much, Alek was convinced she blamed him somehow. Though he never said as much, he blamed her father. For now the president rarely moved without Alek at his side. Aside from putting a further strain on an already troubled marriage, Alek's rising prominence in the president's inner circle began drawing the growing attention of the Russian media. Alek discouraged all of it. He never returned reporters' calls. He never issued public statements or responded to requests for interviews or profiles. Yet this hardly dissuaded the press from writing about him. To the contrary, Alek's caginess only created more mystery around him and his rising influence in his father-in-law's administration, which led in turn to more column inches. At one point, a front-page profile in one of Moscow's most read daily papers described Alek as Luganov's «Nadyozhny Sovietny», or trusted advisor. Alec went pale when he first read the story, certain it would infuriate the very man whose trust he most needed and valued. But Luganov loved the story, even with all its factual inaccuracies, and began describing his son-in-law as his Nadyozhny Savetny to everyone he met. Yet, even as Alek's stature inside the Kremlin was growing, so was his disquietude. While Marina embraced the astonishing wealth her father was amassing, Alek knew the president's official annual salary was only $137,000. To shepherd a nation was one thing. To fleece the flock was quite another. And Alek continued to see a steady stream of Luganov's political rivals and potential rivals heading for prison, or at least under indictment on charges that seemed unsupported by evidence. Growing tensions between the first couple bothered Alek deeply. He and Marina were invited to the official residence less and less often. His mother-in-law, Yulia, rarely traveled with her husband anymore. Indeed, Alek couldn't help but feel guilty that the surge in his own travels with the president was somehow responsible for the dramatic decline in the first ladies. When Yulia came to visit her grandson, she was more often than not alone with her security detail. She didn't say anything about her marital troubles, of course, certainly not to Alek. Perhaps she confided in Marina. But Alek felt it too sensitive a topic to ask Marina about. So he said nothing. But he was not blind. He could see that the family strains were growing deeper. Remembering Yulia's sourness at Vasily's baptism, he suspected things had been going south for some time. What unsettled Alek most of all, however, were the lies he saw the president communicate to his most senior advisers. The man was playing a dangerous double game with most of his cabinet, ordering them to pursue various foreign policies in various regions of the world, while he was independently pursuing policies that were in direct contradiction. Wouldn't all this catch up to him one day? 31. Moscow, August 2013. Alek was already fearful about the president's plans. But a late afternoon meeting in the Kremlin, when Iran's new president arrived for a state visit, turned out to be downright terrifying.
"Welcome, my friend. You have journeyed a long distance," Luganov said upon receiving the Persian leader in his flowing robes and Islamic headdress. "How can I be of service to the people of Iran?"
"Your Excellency, you are too kind," came the reply, "especially to receive me on such short notice."
Luganov nodded.
"The Supreme Leader has asked me to express that he is most grateful for your growing and deepening alliance with the Islamic Republic of Iran,"
the Iranian president explained.
"You have already done, and continue to do, so much for us. Building the reactor in Bushehr, sending us technicians to get the reactor up and running, selling us the newest and most advanced weapons systems, providing political cover for us at the UN, thwarting all the sinister tricks the Americans and the Zionists are trying to play."
Luganov nodded again, but said nothing.
"These are such beneficent and generous gifts,"
the Iranian leader continued.
"They are acts of kindness, deeply appreciated at every level of our society and government."
Luganov's icy blue eyes bored into the bearded Iranian leader, but he did not shift in his seat. He did not stir. He remained impassive, sitting at an angle, leaning back slightly to the right, his legs spread, yet every muscle tensed, like a mountain lion feigning rest, but ready to pounce when his prey least expected it. Alec had seen this posture in countless meetings over the years. At first, it had not bothered him. In the beginning of his service at the Kremlin, Alec had thought Luganov was simply disinterested with the petty, pathetic problems of the guests who streamed through his ornate office. But in time, Alec realized this was not disinterest. In truth, Luganov was intensely interested in every thought and every comment of every mayor and president and prime minister and king who walked into his domain. He was an expert at lulling friend and foe alike into a false sense of ease. But in so doing, he was watching for signs of weakness, probing for insecurities and areas of vulnerability. As for Alec himself, his eyes no longer darted around the room as they did the first time he'd entered Luganov's lair. He no longer studied the arched ceiling and crystal chandelier and the glass-enclosed bookshelves and the flags. He knew this room. He knew this man. That's why he could not risk losing his focus. Despite the fact that it was the middle of a warm afternoon in August, despite the fact that the man from Tehran was droning endlessly on, despite the fact that the cup of tea on the end table beside Alec was empty, and that he was beginning to feel drowsy, he reminded himself that he needed to maintain optimum discipline. The Iranian leader shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
In light of all these acts of brotherhood and unity, the Supreme Leader has asked me to visit you and express a sense of urgency about two requests we are hesitant to put forward, but about which we believe we have no other choice.
Please, go on, Luganov said, evincing no fatigue whatsoever. The Persian cleared his throat.
The first matter is the Supreme Leader's outstanding invitation for you to come to Tehran for a state visit. I want to assure you, Mr. President, this visit would greatly honor our people and send a powerful message to our enemies around the world that our alliance with Moscow is strong and enduring.
Luganov gave no reply.
Yes, well, Your Excellency, I have... Rather, I was hoping to discuss... Well, another matter, too.
Luganov waited.
This concerns, well, the S-400.
At this, Alec looked up from his notes. Even Luganov seemed to stiffen.
The Supreme Leader understands, of course, that this is your most advanced surface-to-air missile system,
the Iranian hastened to add, appearing almost embarrassed.
But I have come because the Supreme Leader believes we need it, and we need it quickly.
Why quickly? Luganov asked.
I believe you know why, Your Excellency.
The tactic was a mistake, Alec knew from experience. But he kept his head down and stayed focused on his shorthand, describing every word of the conversation.
Enlighten me, Luganov said.
The Zionists, sir,
the Persian replied.
What about them?
We believe the Israeli Prime Minister is actively considering an airstrike.
I was just with him, Luganov said. You are mistaken.
Perhaps, Your Excellency, but we have reason to believe the Zionists are planning to attack the reactor at Bushehr, and ultimately all of our other nuclear research and development sites, before they become fully operational.
During his years of working for his father-in-law, Alec had seen Luganov interact with dozens of world leaders, including Russia's most important client states. But he had never seen anyone pursue military hardware more brazenly than the Iranians. They were as shameless as they were relentless. Now they wanted to buy a billion-dollar missile system, arguably the most sophisticated system in Moscow's arsenal, with hard, cold cash, because they believed the Israelis were poised to attack their nuclear facilities before they could build the bomb. They were asking, even though they knew the Israeli government had promised Luganov they would not launch a preemptive strike in the next 18 months, unless Iran installed an air defense system that would make a future airstrike nearly impossible. Thus, by asking for the S-400 system, the Iranians were actually accelerating any timetable the Israelis might have for hitting Iran's nuclear facilities. Alek did his best not to laugh out loud as he waited for Luganov to dismiss such an audacious and impertinent request. Alek had seen it happen before. Leaders would come to this office and overreach, sometimes by a little, often by a lot. Either way, Luganov would slap them down. The leaders would apologize profusely and change the subject, and all would be forgotten. Alek fully expected it to happen again. But to his astonishment, it did not. To the contrary, for the better part of the next 90 minutes, he watched as Luganov and the Iranian president negotiated a deal for Moscow to sell Tehran the S-400 system. A simultaneous deal for Iran to purchase North Korean nuclear testing data via Moscow. And a plan for Luganov to make his first state visit to Tehran. Alek faithfully transcribed every facet of the negotiations, though with each passing minute, his horror grew. They were planning to set the Middle East on fire. 32. Perhaps the only thing more egregious than seeing the President of Russia agree to sell the S-400 missile system to Iran was seeing the contours of the deal splashed across the front page of one of Russia's most widely read newspapers the next morning. The moment Alek picked up the paper at his front door and read the story, a shudder rippled through his body. He had no idea who at the Kremlin had leaked the deal, but he was quite sure heads were going to roll. As he drove to the office, Alek listened to wall-to-wall radio coverage of the bombshell exclusive that was the talk not only of all Moscow, but every capital from Washington to Jerusalem to Beijing. The article had been written by Galina Polonskaya, far and away the most respected journalist in the country. Now past 50, the graying, bespectacled Polonskaya had long been one of the best-sourced political columnists in Moscow. Years before, she had been the first to report that Luganov was about to be plucked out of obscurity and appointed head of the FSB. Later, she broke the story that he was going to be named prime minister, and she was the first to profile his remarkable rise to power. She also broke the bribery scandal that felled Luganov's first finance minister, and she exposed the multiple marital affairs and illegal financial payoffs from foreign petroleum companies that brought down the head of Russia's biggest gas company, a scandal that allowed Luganov to install one of his closest friends, a man with no experience in the gas business, as the company's new CEO. For the last 2 decades, she had painstakingly planted, watered, weeded, and protected her sources. Now all the seeds she had planted seemed to be yielding a bumper crop. Polonskaya struck Alek as fiercely independent. She wasn't a wholly owned subsidiary of the Kremlin political machine. She was a courageous, if lonely, voice against all manner of corruption and shady political goings-on. 6 months earlier, she'd written a column alleging that Luganov had amassed 20 palaces and villas, 15 helicopters, a 53-meter yacht, and 9 luxury watches worth more than $10,000 each since becoming president of the Russian Federation. Luganov's press secretary completely overreacted, blasting the story as malicious lies from the pit of hell. Zakharov had publicly eviscerated Polonskaya as an enemy of the truth and thus an enemy of the people, and had leaked a bogus story about how Polonskaya had been accused of plagiarizing her thesis while a doctoral candidate at Moscow State University. The only inaccuracy Alek could see in the column was that Luganov actually owned 11 such watches, not 9. His father-in-law spoke about money all the time, more than politics, more than hockey or hunting or the Olympic Games, all of which he loved. Luganov had not been raised with money. His parents had lived a very modest life. Yet now he seemed obsessed with amassing an unrivaled fortune. Nothing was enough for him. His appetites were insatiable. Initially, Yulia hadn't seemed to mind. At least she hadn't voiced any objections. Neither had Marina. They enjoyed the finer things in life. So, for that matter, did Alek, though he found himself increasingly embarrassed by, and at times even ashamed of, his father-in-law's ostentatious displays of wealth, especially when most Russians were barely scraping by. It was bad for the image of the presidency. It was bad for Russia's image overall. Yet, no one inside or outside the Kremlin had the courage to raise concerns with the president, Alek among them. 13 days after the article about Luganov's wealth was published, Polonskaya's husband, Mikhail, a renowned oncologist, had died in a private plane crash near the Black Sea. The entire episode was a mystery. The crash had occurred in the middle of the day, in beautiful weather, with an experienced pilot and co-pilot at the controls. Alek was sickened when he heard the news. Even more so when he saw the pleasure on the president's face after Zakharov mentioned the story during a senior staff meeting. If such a fate had befallen the woman's husband after she had exposed the Russian leader's exorbitant wealth, what fate would now befall her for exposing the arms deal with the tyrants in Tehran? And what would happen to whoever had leaked the story? Alek got into the office early, but no sooner had he made himself a cup of chai and begun returning emails than he was summoned to the office of the chief of staff. Zakharov's executive assistant looked pale when Alek came in. She immediately hit a buzzer on her desk and nodded to a security agent standing in front of the door to the inner office. The agent stepped aside and opened the door. The assistant gestured to Alek, and Alek entered. As quickly as he did, the door shut behind him.
"What do you have to say for yourself, Alek Stefanovich?"
Zakharov bellowed. Alek stood there, speechless. He'd known heads were going to roll, but he'd had no idea it would be his head on the chopping block.
"How many people were in that meeting yesterday?"
the chief of staff demanded, shouting so loudly, Alek was sure he could be heard throughout the entire floor. He did not wait for an answer.
"Four. Just 4 people were in that room. The 2 presidents, the Aravian note-taker, and you. That's it. Yet this morning, Galina Polonskaya is telling the world all about one of our most sensitive alliances and arms deals. How is that possible? We trusted you, Alek Stefanovich. I trusted you. Now get out. Leave. Go home. Reconsider your life. Reconsider your loyalties. If you were not the president's son-in-law, you would already be in prison."
Mortified, Alek did not even return to his office to get his briefcase or his suit jacket. Instead, he immediately took an elevator down into the parking garage and began driving around the city. He did not head home. He did not call Marina. What exactly was he supposed to say? Minutes ago, he had been accused of breaking half a dozen laws, and those were just the ones the former lawyer could think of off the top of his head. He had been accused by the president's chief of staff of leaking highly classified national security secrets. Surely a fair investigation would prove his innocence. But would it be fair? Or was someone out to frame him? But why? What had he done wrong? Hadn't he been a loyal servant of the president? Alep chewed on such questions for the better part of an hour as he left Moscow and began heading north. Beads of perspiration broke out on his forehead. His hands felt cold and clammy. Whom could he trust right now? Certainly no one at the Kremlin, that much was clear. Certainly not his parents. They nearly worshipped the president. In their eyes, Luganov could do no wrong. He was the guardian, indeed the savior, of Russia, especially since the apartment bombings and Luganov's brutal and unrelenting attacks on Chechnya. What about Marina? If there was one person he wanted to spill everything to, all his fears, his doubts, his myriad and growing suspicions, it was the wife he adored. But how could he? The woman he most loved was the daughter of the man he most feared. 33. Moscow, August 21st, 2013. Galina Polonskaya stepped into the sunshine. Throughout the morning and early afternoon, she'd had a string of television interviews via satellite uplinks with the BBC and CNN International, and Sky News, and even Israel's Channel 2. Having just finished a lengthy sit-down interview about the S-400 deal with the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times, she now put on her sunglasses and strolled down a crowded boulevard, heading to the garage where she had parked her car. When she reached the historic Hotel National, within sight of the Kremlin, she stopped for a moment and just stood there, staring at the building's facade. She remembered all too well the bitterly cold December day nearly a decade earlier when the hotel had been the target of a suicide bombing. Polonskaya had been browsing the stores nearby along with thousands of other Christmas shoppers and was one of the first on the scene. She remembered the heavy snow and whipping winds. Much more vividly, she remembered the smell of blood and burnt flesh, and the sight of severed body parts. It was another bloody day in a city that had seen too many of them over the years she had been reporting. Feeling spontaneous, she entered the lobby, looked around, found the cafe, and asked for a table near a window. She ordered a cup of chai and stared out at the traffic and the shoppers, and didn't want to go home. She couldn't exactly explain why. She wondered if she simply couldn't bear the thought of being alone in her big, drafty, empty house on the east side of the city, missing her husband and feeling sorry for herself. She preferred drinking in the hum and rhythm of this metropolis. She sat there for close to an hour, people watching, returning a few emails, sipping tea, and avoiding the inevitable. The gaping chasm in her soul was physically excruciating. She had met her husband at Moscow State. He was in medical school. She was studying political science and journalism. They had fallen madly in love, and had remained so for almost 30 years. She couldn't remember a fight, and barely a quarrel. Now he was gone. His family wouldn't talk to her. His parents had cut her off, accusing her of costing their only son his life because of what they called her vain ambitions. That had wounded her the most, not because she felt the stab of injustice, but because she feared they were right. The only solace she seemed to find was not lying down and surrendering in the face of the Tsar rising in their midst. She had to keep digging, snooping, reporting, exposing. If she stopped now, she thought, her husband's death, his cold, calculated, premeditated, and utterly unnecessary murder would have been in vain. She had no doubt the Kremlin had killed him. Very likely Luganov had ordered the hit himself. She couldn't say that.